The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with some stories that have shown up lately on our daily news site. Okay, David, in the first story, a cell becomes a laser. Now, how does that happen?
Well, this is a really interesting story because for the 50 years or so that lasers have been around, they've always been based on inanimate materials, solids, liquids, or gases, never anything biological. So what's really cool about this study is this is the first, according to the researchers, biological laser.
Well, what is a biological laser?
Well, the way a traditional laser works is basically by pumping atoms or molecules in a gas or a liquid or solid into a more energetic state, getting them more excited. And usually do this with electricity or sometimes chemically or even sometimes with another laser. And what happens is once these atoms, say, get pumped up and they get very excited, they eventually decay and they emit a photon. And this photon will begin tipping the other atoms from their excited states and releases this torrent of new photons. And it's sort of this snowball effect. And these photons essentially keep on amplifying themselves. They bounce back and forth between two mirrors. And eventually some of the light gets out in a characteristically focused beam, sort of what you think of when you think of a laser. Anyways, that's how it traditionally works. And what scientists wanted to do in this new study was figure out, can we replicate this on a cellular level? Can we make a cell basically do the same thing that a laser does?
And so cells, I know, have expressed, you know, green fluorescent proteins. And is that part of this story?
That is. And it's exactly green fluorescent protein, also known as GFP. Scientists call it for short. This was a protein that was isolated from jellyfish in the early 1960s. And as you alluded to, Stuart, it makes cells glow green. The other really cool thing about GFP is it can be inserted into practically any cell. And scientists use it to study how proteins move around in cells, to do a variety of other things. It's a really nice sort of tracer protein. And this new study, scientists said, well, you know, we've already got this protein that's emitting light, it's emitting green light. Can we sort of focus it and amplify it so it becomes more like a laser beam? So they took human kidney cells, which normally don't express GFP, and they inserted GFP into them. And then they tried to replicate sort of what happens with a laser. And what they did was they took a couple cells that express GFP. And with one of these cells, they pumped it with another laser. This laser emitted blue light. And this was, again, a way to get the photons in the GFP excited. And normally the blue light would simply make the GFP in that cell fluoresce and glow green. But what they did was they put these couple cells inside a very tight cavity, and that this cavity also had mirrors in it, just like a laser would. And what happened was when this one cell was excited, it bounced back and forth between the two cells, amplifying the emission until the researchers saw a green beam, just like you might see. Well, maybe not just like you would see from a normal laser, but essentially the same idea you would see from a laser.
Well, it sounds pretty cool, but it's kind of hard to know what the application would be.
Right. It's cool. And the question is, where do they go from here? And the scientists actually have a number of ideas. There's a lot of thinking about using lasers to kill cancer cells in the body. But obviously, if you're using a big laser, that can be very destructive. But if you can make the lasers very small and put them in cells that are actually in the body anyways, it might be useful for a way to better target cancer cells.
Sort of cell-based laser surgery.
Exactly. Also, some other applications that have nothing to do with cancer. There's a lot of work right now about developing human biological interfaces, ways for people that are quote unquote locked in, people that have no way of communicating with the outside world, either because they can't speak or they can't move any parts of their body, but may still be able to use their mind. It's possible that a biological laser-based system might allow people in wheelchairs that are locked in to manipulate their wheelchair, to even communicate on keyboards. And one of the coolest applications the scientists have in mind is this idea of self-healing lasers. All the lasers we have today are all mechanical and mechanics break down, but cells can be regenerated. So the idea is if you have a laser made of cells versus lasers made of mechanical parts, you may be able to create lasers that can repair themselves, which would be pretty cool.
And next, going Pandora one better, something about predicting music sales and preferences through brain scans.
Well, right, Stuart. The study came about, in a very interesting way. A couple years ago, a scientist named Gregory Burns, who's a neuroeconomist at Emory University in Atlanta, was sitting on the couch with his kids, and he was watching American Idol, which is a very popular show in the U.S. where contestants try to out-sing each other. And one of the contestants was singing a song called Apologize, which is by a group called One Republic. And when the song aired, something clicked in Burns' mind. He said, you know what? I remember using this song in one of my studies. A couple of years ago, he was studying students in his lab, and he was basically trying to figure out how kids respond to peer pressure when they pick their musical choices. Do they just decide they like songs because they inherently like them, or do they decide they like a song because they've been told that their peers like the song as well? And as part of the study, these teenagers listened to about 100 odd songs, and they had their brains scanned while they were listening to the songs to sort of figure out what was going on in their brains. Well, it turns out a lot of the songs, in fact, most of the songs that were played for these kids were very obscure songs that the researchers found on MySpace and other sites. Songs they wouldn't have heard before, songs by groups that really hadn't been signed. And in this new study, Burns said, well, you know what? I wonder if any of those songs have become popular in the past couple of years. And if they have, I wonder if any of that brain scan data we had would have predicted whether these songs would have become popular or
and
not.
And it did.
And it did. Amazingly, it did. What the researchers found is when they correlated the brain scan data they had taken a couple years ago with data from Nielsen SoundScan, which is basically a service that tracks music sales, they saw a correlation in activity in the nucleus accumbens of the brain, which is a region of the brain that's linked to reward and anticipation. And basically, the higher the activity in this region of the brain, the more likely a song was to become popular. Now, it wasn't a perfect correlation. The nucleus accumbens only accounted for about a 10% variance in song sales, but it was still a correlation.
Does that mean that music companies are going to start scanning people's brains?
Well, it's a really interesting question. There's actually a field called neuromarketing where some companies are actually trying to see whether they can predict consumer preference just by brain scan. Because one of the interesting things the researchers found in this study, besides the fact that they saw this correlation, was that this correlation was actually stronger than what the kids said their musical preferences were. So if the kids said, hey, I really like song X, chances are song X wouldn't tend to be the song that actually became popular. But if their brains said, hey, you really seem to be liking song X, that was far more predictive. And so for neuromarketers, they might be really interested in this data. Though, as one expert points out, this is really preliminary stuff, and he wouldn't invest in any company right now that was going to use this data. He says it's just way too preliminary. So something to look out for, but it's not going to change the world of consumer preferences just yet.
Okay, I won't change my portfolio.
Right.
Finally, a magnetic alternative to cardiovascular medicines. What's that all about?
Right, Stuart, well, this last story is about using magnets to help try to prevent stroke. And one of the leading causes of strokes and heart attacks, which is actually one of the leading causes of death in the industrialized world, is blood viscosity, meaning basically the thicker your blood is, the more likely you are to have a stroke and a heart attack. And that's because thicker blood tends to damage blood vessels. And when the body tries to repair the damage, the vessels build up fatty deposits, which makes strokes and heart attacks more likely. Now,
and that's why aspirin is given for these conditions, correct?
Exactly. Aspirin is very highly prescribed for this because aspirin thins the blood. But aspirin has side effects. In high doses, it can cause stomach bleeding, ulcers, or even tinnitus, which is a ringing of the ears. So in this new study, scientists were trying to figure out, is there a safer alternative to aspirin? And they hit upon magnets. Now, magnets are already used in medicine. If you've ever gotten an MRI, magnets of strengths of 1 to 3 Tesla are already used. And as far as researchers can tell, these magnets don't have any side effects. So they're pretty safe. And so the researchers in this study said, well, what if we used a magnet that emits about 1 Tesla and we apply it to a blood sample? Can we change the viscosity? And in fact, they found they could. When they put this blood sample in the lab under this magnetic force for about a minute, the viscosity reduced by about 20 to 30%.
That's a pretty big effect. How's it working?
Well, they're pretty sure it has to do with hemoglobin, which is this iron-based protein in red blood cells. They think basically that in the same way that iron fillings would align themselves along the field lines of a bar magnet, so too do red blood cells align themselves along the field lines of the magnet that was used in this study. And this reduces viscosity in a couple ways. First of all, the cells all start to sort of point in the same direction, or at least the direction of the flow. So they're not sort of going in different directions, which would increase viscosity. They're all sort of flowing very nicely. Also, the researchers think that this alignment actually helps the cells stick together. Now, you might think that actually increases viscosity, but when cells form these small clumps, these clumps actually have less surface area than individual cells themselves, which actually makes the blood less viscous.
So is there any disadvantages of doing it this way?
Well, one disadvantage is, or at least one challenge is, that the blood that's being subjected to the magnet must all be flowing in the same direction. So you couldn't just put a magnet on somebody's whole body because you've got all these vessels and capillaries that are running in various different directions. But the researchers say that you may not need to do that. If you just focus the magnet on one particular, say, vein or artery that was running in one direction, even if you did it for a short period of time, the effect would be transmitted to the rest of the body because if you're decreasing the viscosity in one localized area, that blood is getting pumped to the rest of the body where it still maintains that low viscosity. And after a short period of time, theoretically, most of the blood in the body viscosity would be reduced as well. But it's important to note this is very preliminary. It's a very interesting and exciting idea, but the researchers have just tested this on blood in basically a vial in the lab. They have not even gone into animal studies yet. So it's a promising idea, but still a lot of work needs to be done.
Okay, David, what other stories are you looking at for the news site this week?
Well, Stuart, we've got a story for Science Now about why female finches cheat, and it may have to do with a promiscuity gene that is passed.
A promiscuity gene.
Exactly. It's passed from parents to offspring. Also, a story about a mysterious gamma ray burst that's been detected and how it may be linked to a black hole eating a star. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about death threats that are being fielded against Australian climate scientists, and also a story about how U.S. President Barack Obama is under fire for canceling a planned nuclear waste facility in Nevada. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week we've got a chat about the dangers or perhaps lack thereof of cell phone use. We're going to have a couple experts on that will answer all of your questions about what the latest scientific studies say about how harmful or perhaps how not harmful cell phones are. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.